Welcome to the Work Design Podcast. Listen to the world's greatest leaders share their stories and secrets on how they designed and built the best places to work. We'll shine a light on the challenges and breakthroughs of designing org charts, optimizing teams, and building jobs that people love. This is for modern leaders who are building the best teams at scale. Let's make work work better.
Today, our guest is Marcus Tan, the co-founder and CEO at Health Engine, a marketplace for specialist and doctor appointments here in Western Australia that's pushing out to be a platform for so much more. Marcus, tell us a little bit about yourself and Health Engine, where you guys are at now.
Yeah, thanks, Tim and Damien. We're, as I said, a tech company based in Western Australia. We've largely been a venture-backed startup, so have been very lucky to attract some pretty high-profile investors that have allowed us to grow very, very quickly. So as you said, we're basically a marketplace that helps people find and book their health appointments online. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough to be able to grow a market-leading national business out of Perth, which is generally seen as not exactly a technology hub in Australia. I'm a doctor by background, so I have no business running a tech company whatsoever, but I guess I'm the domain expert trying to solve a problem that I had many, many years ago using tech. And I've been very fortunate to being able to build a team around me. And at, you know, various times, the team has been, you know, sort of north of 150 odd people. And we're currently sitting around about 110.
Marcus, tell us about the start of that journey. How many people were in the original team when you came on board? What did it all look like when the journey started?
Yeah, so for me, it was because I'm not technical, I can't code to save my life. I had two developers that I brought on to try to solve this problem of just navigating the healthcare system with good information. You know, I was actually looking to try and find doctors. As a doctor, I'm here to try and help patients navigate the healthcare system as a GP, and referring them to specialists was one of my roles, and we didn't have good resources at the time to do that. So I was looking to build effectively that and needed to find the people who could code. And so brought on two tech co-founders, if you like, into my lounge room at the time. And that was the beginning of our story.
And then how did things grow from there?
Well, as I said, I mean, you know, we sort of muddled around for a little while trying to find product market fit. At the point where we were getting sort of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people actually using the site a month, you know, we could see that we were getting traction, but we weren't always immediately able to see where we were going to monetize. The health market at the time weren't necessarily looking for marketing tools because they were usually quite busy. And so, you know, paying to try and attract new patients wasn't really a thing. But we knew that there was people getting value from it. So we were trying to unlock a business model. At a point where we pivoted somewhat from just being a directory, which is kind of, you know, help people find things, to a appointment, you know, appointment booking service where people could actually transact, that really kind of changed the business significantly. And it was around that time that we actually secured our first angel investor as well. And that helped us sort of develop the tech and develop, you know, sort of the market a little bit into online bookings, which was the thing that we kind of pioneered in Australia. We're currently taking around about 1.1 million bookings a month. You know, back in 2011-12, which is when we kind of launched that service, it just didn't exist really in healthcare. So really, in many ways, we're very proud of that particular achievement. And I guess that allowed us to sort of go to millions of users a month, and, you know, and that's, you know, that helped us also attract other money, particularly venture capital sort of money, sort of more institutional money. And really, I guess that's just kind of fueled the fire to grow more, you know, get more users. And obviously, as you get more users, you want to build more product, and you build more product, you need more engineers, and you need more engineers. You also, you know, need product guys. And then, you know, as you build more of these products, you need to sell them, and you need to get more salespeople. And so it becomes this round of, you know, of as you grow, you need more and more of different types of functions and skills. And in many ways, when you don't have money, you don't have, you sort of attract the sort of skills that you deserve, if you kind of get what I'm saying. So we had, you know, some very passionate people who weren't necessarily particularly skilled, including myself, doing sales and other things. But as you attract more capital, you can actually afford to buy professional level help. And that's, you know, what we end up doing.
And it probably at that stage started to outgrow your living room a little bit.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, my wife was annoyed enough to have all these strangers in our living room long enough that they kicked us. She kicked us out after about 6 months. She couldn't handle it anymore. So yeah, I mean, we've evolved into several office spaces as we've grown, and that's been a challenge in of itself, right? Because, you know, when you're a fast growing business, trying to predict what your office requirements are from, you know, one lease to the next, you don't really want to be signing on large leases. But by the same token, you want to provide some level of certainty for your team and stuff like that. So yeah, that's certainly been one of the challenges of growing.
Now, one of the things we focus on for the podcast and fascinates me and Damien is this concept of work design or being intentional in how you start going through that motion of adding other functions into the organization, and particularly as CEO and the senior leadership team, how you structure them. We kind of divide them into a couple of kind of areas to talk about. One's organizational design. How do you structure the organization? How do you structure the teams within the organization? How do you optimize a team? And then at the individual level, how does that all cascade down to provide clarity for the 110 people that you've got working at Health Engine? Mm-hmm. As you've gone through that scale, what do you feel like starts to break for you and cause pain for you and the team? And how have you thought about those different dimensions of building out the organization?
Yep. So, I mean, to say that we designed work certainly as a startup is a complete fallacy, right? Like, I mean, it just happens where I think when you're small and you start with a few people, it's relatively easy in the sense that you do what is required, you know, like, so, yep. You know, at the beginning as the CEO, you know, it's a fancy title, but you end up doing the books, you end up doing like sales, you end up doing like, you know, as the admin, you do all the sort of the stuff that you wouldn't ordinarily attribute to most CEOs, like, you know, because you just have to. You know, the proverbial cook, cleaner and bottle washer and everything else, like, you know, your front of house, back of house, you're doing everything. But of course, as you get more capacity or, you know, funds to have people come in to start divvying out more of that work and delegating more of that work, it becomes more of a, I guess, more designed in the sense that it's more of a structure. But, you know, in the early days, there wasn't much design or structure around it. It was just all hands on deck. You know, whatever needed to get done, got done, right? And certainly, I think part of the reason, I think, why we're a little bit smaller than the 150 where we were sort of at the peak of our headcount was this whole Dunbar number thing, like, you know, being around about 150 yeah. is a real thing, because certainly as you have more and more people in the organization, complexity becomes hugely becomes huge, right? So trying to ensure that people are all aligned and, you know, clear about what they're doing, and also I guess not having so much overlap in terms of just redundancy of people, you know, to bumping into each other doing the same things or like whatever, that becomes a real problem. Whereas if it's just three of us, you know, sort of in a living room, we can say, hey, look, I'm going to be calling so-and-so, you're going to be coding and you're going to be designing. And it's a very clear delineation. It's very easy. Whereas communication, when it becomes with more and more people, it becomes much more uncertain or less clear about what everybody's doing.
Can you give some examples, some sort of more concrete examples of around 150 staff, what you saw happening, which was painful to you or to the organization?
Look, I mean, it became very clear that we were sometimes because we were quite well funded at the time. So, you know, and, you know, to some extent, pretty, you know, some people would say still are. But I think, you know, when you're sort of, there's an expectation you grow really, really quickly, you tend to solve problems by throwing money at it.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, that's just what tends to happen. And you tend to say, hey, look, I need to get all these things done. Let's just hire a whole bunch of people to get it done. And because there's generally a shortage of engineers, building automated systems to try and reduce the headcount is not the first place you go, because you've got to try and work out what exactly it is that you want to automate. And so you need to have processes and people run through it. So in many ways, having the people hired to do a whole bunch of things that you want to do to grow is exactly what I just said, right? Like, it depended on what we needed at the time. And if sales was the thing, because we did have a basis of a product, then we just need to sell and sell like crazy. Okay, so like, how do we scale a sales team?
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, it was like, who are the best salespeople we know? And, you know, like you tend to go to your existing networks, because nobody loves using recruiters, but sometimes that's what you have to do if you want to scale. Then you have to pay a lot of money for that. And then, you know, it's about finding the people who have a cultural fit, which isn't always easy when you haven't got a lot of choice. And then, like, you know, the people with the requisite experience but being able to sort of line all those things up. Sometimes it's not as neat as that when you just need a whole bunch of people in seats. And so you end up making a lot of mistakes, because you hire the wrong people, and, you know, and being a startup, because you're constantly looking at your processes anyway, and they're all experiments because they just don't exist. You don't know whether it's the people who are screwing up the processes or it's the processes that you put in place that weren't working. And it just creates a lot of complexity. It just shows up as that. And there are many times where I actually found that I felt it was really wasteful, because there were times I was sitting in the office going, what does that person do?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I'm sure, I mean, we're not, you know, terrible people. Like, I'm sure they do something. They look busy, but I'm not actually sure what they actually produce for us. And I think it's very easy to get up in that mode where you kind of feel, oh, God, like, you know, why have we got so many people, right?
Yeah. And it sounds like your thinking's changed about that. So that there was a change in thinking from let's throw people at the problem to now let's think about this a little bit differently. Can you tell us about how that thinking shifted and what you saw at that time?
Yeah, I think it's also an evolution of the business, right? So as time has gone on, you know, we've been very fortunate to have built up quite a large user base. So, you know, traction has been something that we've been able to get. And it's at those times you sort of go, well, look, okay, now that we've got, Tim sort of mentioned it, we've got this platform, what else can we do? And then once you've actually evolved from selling and marketing to building product to add more value to the people that we've already got, it changes the focus in terms of the functional emphasis in the business. Yeah. So you go from being maybe sales and marketing led to being more product and engineering led. And then therefore, you know, you have to now change the skill set mix and reduce down one and start investing in the other. So, you know, in that sense, it becomes different. And I guess to the extent that we've also gone from a high growth, high burn type of, you know, thinking to a more sustainable burn, like, you know, less headcount type of environment, because heads are expensive, especially in Australia. You know, and certain the types of heads that we're talking about, both in sales and in product and engineering, they're expensive heads generally. So it's not like, you know, you can, you know, it's noticeable when you hire people. So I think that you've got to be much more judicious about the way that you hire now in, you know, again, depending on the phase of your business and whether they're pure revenue accretive, value accretive type of heads that you're hiring, or it's nice to have admin, you know, that makes your life a little bit easier, but it isn't necessarily creating any immediate value to your customers or to the company, if you kind of get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it sounds like there's a transition there from that scale people to the point that you transitioned and sized your organization a little bit smaller. Tell us about that transition. How did that affect the organization around you, and how long did that transition take?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I'm a big believer in you know, the concept of the sigmoid curve, where, you know, basically you go up and you're scaling, you're growing quite quickly, but in order to hit the next peak, you've got to actually kind of, you know, sort of take stock, you know, sort of pare back a little bit, and, you know, before you can go back up again. So in many ways, you know, the business has sort of reflected that same sort of theory, the sigmoid type of theory, and really, I guess, you know, for us, I think it was really just to say that, you know, again, it reflects the transitions, you know, in terms of the pivots that we've made around core focus and other things, the life cycle of the business. You know, the changes have been painful, right? I mean, like, you know, when you grow a business that it's not huge. I mean, 150 people is not a lot of people in the whole scheme of things. I mean, a lot of corporates, this is a small division in their, you know, multi-departmental sort of org structure. But it's family, right? I mean, as a startup, it's very personal. You bring people on and they're, you know, you're sort of, you know, selling them on the dream of joining you on this rocket ship, and, you know, and they love it. And, you know, you've kind of responsible for their livelihoods. And the minute you've got to let people go or change tack or make sure that, like, you know, you reassess the types of skills, they're not even bad people. It's just that they're not the right fit for what you need right now. How do you have those conversations? And they're tough conversations to have. You know, people join the rocket ship because they want to solve a problem, and now they don't feel like they're needed anymore. It's a painful conversation. They feel like family. You feel like you're gonna, yeah. So you know, they're never easy conversations to have. I think some people have gotten so accustomed to doing those sorts of things that it's they're numb to it all. But it's just, you know, having had to do it a few times now, like, it's just never easier. You do get better at it in terms of how the process works and all that sort of stuff, but it never feels easier. You know, I think at some level you have to almost kind of give people an expectation that high growth, high change sort of businesses like startups are, you expect it, right? Like, you know, I mean, you know, people do need to understand life cycles of businesses in order to sort of understand it's not personal, it actually is what's best for the business.
Mm. Could you tell us about your process for designing those sorts of changes? So the things that happen in your head and in your office and in your boardroom before you go out and start making changes in an organization?
I'd like to think that it was more process driven and not as ad hoc as it can be. But, you know, I mean, to the extent that we get information that's new and we try to enact on it as quickly as possible, sometimes it can feel very unplanned. Like, you know, it's just a big rush to get it done rather than, oh, well, you know, we saw this coming. Because new information happens all the time, whether it's a change in market conditions or virus hits or something, something or other changes the market, and a competitor comes in with a new product or something, a customer's not happy and leaves or whatever. There's a whole bunch of these things that in a challenge or an opportunity makes you have to reassess the business, and that's, I guess, the nature of startup, as you guys would be aware. And I think planning is a nice thing to have. It just doesn't seem to always happen that way. And certainly for us, that's been the case. I mean, we go, look, this is the budget and the forecast, and this is what we're working towards. This is how we think about our business. A quarter later, it's completely different, right? This is the opportunity we want to go for now. Our priorities have changed. We've tended to try and work on quarters rather than try to sort of pivot too much. I mean, I know sometimes people go a quarter, that's not very much at all. But, for us, it is, because we used to go for month to month. But trying to create some level of stability and ensuring that everybody's aligned. So we've done that through things like OKRs, whether it's an annual OKR that says, look, we're trying to achieve this more broadly over the year, and then chunk it down over quarters, and then keep reassessing at a quarter level as to whether we're still heading in the right direction, whether, in fact, those annual OKRs are still relevant, all that sort of stuff. That's a very useful alignment tool around goals that we want to achieve as a business. And then, of course, people then can cascade that to their own personal OKRs to make sure that, that whatever they're doing is contributing to that overall goal. These are all part and parcel of, some of the things that we put in place.
Yeah. Now, at Health Engine, I know a lot of companies would have some kind of document that communicates an individual's personal responsibilities to the organization, like a job description or personal responsibilities or position responsibilities. How do you deal with that at Health Engine? Do you call it a job description? And how have you personally found that process when you're going through hiring a new role in the executive team or hiring someone in the organization?
So we don't call it a job description. We call it a gig guide. It's just a colloquialism, I think, that's specific to Australia. I'm not sure if anybody else calls it that anywhere else in the world, but that's certainly what we call it. It's a pretty loose sort of document, in the sense that, things get added, things get, sort of changed and amended, in that sense, depending on, again, we want to sometimes preserve, sure, it's a role-based thing, but it's also, we try to accommodate the person to that, so that, if the role does change somewhat, we can kind of accommodate the person so that they can continue in the business as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, our philosophy has always been that if we can redeploy talent within our business, we should. We sometimes try to be a bit flexible around the roles that are available in the business to do that. It's not always ideal because, as I said, you can sometimes artificially end up causing problems by reduplicating other roles elsewhere and, functions overlap and so on.
So rather than sticking to the role exactly as it's documented, you'd customize a role specifically to fit the right people?
It can sometimes feel that way, but we do that reluctantly only because it can create problems. Sometimes it's better just to understand where the roles are within an org chart, and these are, it's much easier to carve those things out than try to be too malleable around it.
Yeah.
Because it has unintended knock-on effects on, how, as I said, it can bump into other roles and other things. Where it actually becomes sort of, for us, kind of where the rubber hits the road, I think, for gig guides isn't so much that we go back to the gig guide every quarter or every month. We actually have a thing called a one-page accountability. And what that really is, it's kind of a reflection on what does the line manager want to see out of the quarter from you, right? Forgetting about your gig guide and everything else, what can we talk about as a shared understanding of what you're accountable for delivering within the quarter? And, it's a dialogue like everything else. And once you've documented it, it forms the basis of a performance, review that says, hey, look, did you manage to get through what you said you were going to do? And if you didn't, well, let's talk about the inputs and why you didn't, and there are very good reasons why you didn't. But at least it's a base document of a shared understanding that goes beyond the gig guide. The gig guide is just high level, BAU sort of stuff, just talking about your role, but not necessarily what you're looking to achieve, if you kind of get what I'm saying. And I think that's those are the sort of two documents. I mean, of course, people have their OKRs and other things, but the two documents specific to a role is that.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you think to a time when you've had to make the decision to hire, obviously that can be very expensive if the hire goes wrong. How do you think about maximizing the hiring process and getting the right person and minimizing the chances of problems?
Yeah, so look, I don't think any system is 100% foolproof. I think at point in time, even if you think that they're 100% the right fit and, you know, it's perfect, people's circumstances change and, you know, for one reason or another, they may or not perform right in the role. So, I think, there's no 100% perfect system. But what we do is we actually go through quite an exhaustive sort of recruitment process. So it's multi-staged, where you have a technical, obviously you apply for whatever role and usually submit your CV and what else not. In some of the engineering type of roles, you actually have to sit a hacker rank test and, you know, all these sorts of things that just demonstrates that you can, how you think about problems and, you know, and have sufficient level of competency, I guess, in a certain role like engineering, which is very problem solving based. And then you'd go through a more technical interview, a proper face-to-face interview rather than just sitting in front of your computer and filling out a couple of tests to see whether you can talk through stuff. And then you might sit through a culture fit interview, which is a whole separate panel of people who you'd go and talk to. And sometimes it's on the same day, but often it's multi-dayed. And then I try to, if possible, meet every single person that joins the business before they join the business. And then usually I talk to them about the fact that I'm not the expert here. I'm not the hiring manager usually. And so I'm not there to assess whether you can do the job or whether even in fact you're the right fit. I'm actually there to make sure that A, you get the signal that A, the business cares about you as an individual and that, you know, enough for the CEO to want to get involved. And so we're a very flat structure and we want to make sure that you feel that the CEO is approachable all the way through to all your managers, but the CEO is approachable and that if you have ideas and other things, the ice is already broken. You don't have to worry about wandering through the corridors going, oh God, that's the CEO. Should I talk to them? You know, that doesn't happen. They already know who I am and that's an easy part. But actually more specifically, it's about really giving them the, you know, eyes wide open on joining a startup. Because startups are just a weird thing. Like most people haven't worked in one. They might have worked in large corporate and have completely the wrong view of how to think about stuff in startup. And so really just giving them a sense of, look, you know, it's a roller coaster you're joining. And even at the point where you love roller coasters, and a lot of people do, it still can be very, you know, hair-raising and not, you know, stomach in your mouth sort of moments because you change a lot and there's a lot of things that are very uncertain and you've got to roll the punches and it's just a different environment. And so you've got to just kind of come in knowing that that's what you're buying yourself into. And so long as people are very well aware of that, that's what I'm trying to extract. So, you know, it's a very long process and some people love it actually. When they come in, they'll often say that that's a process that they really enjoy.
Yeah.
And the people who don't survive the process, I never kind of get. It's a survivor bias sort of problem.
Yeah. Well, that's a massive commitment as a CEO to interview every person or speak to every person. Can you think of a time when that's really paid back, where that investment has really shown its worth?
Look, I mean, I'd like to think that it pays back every day only because, like as I said, if it makes the business feel less hierarchical and more flat and it gives people the opportunity to engage with you, like people tend to be more real. They tend to, you know, they treat you as a person rather than as the boss or whatever it is. And they just tend to become more transparent, like, you know, in their communications and other things. I think that's a really important part of the culture is that we're just all about being real, like you're authentic. I mean, let's not ignore the fact that there are problems and challenges, but we're here to solve problems. And you can't solve problems if you don't acknowledge that there is a problem, if you know what I mean. So, like, you know, we want that sort of culture, and I think that's a really good way to start. I like it as a form of talent identification, actually. So, you know, I really get a good feel for some of the best interviews I've had with people. I kind of go, that person is going to go far. I really want to, you know, ensure that they have a really good experience of the business because I get the sense that they can be a real superstar for the business, that sort of thing. So being able to just see, wow, okay, cool. Love that guy or girl, you know, like that's paid off.
Yeah, it really helps. What you're saying is it helps both shape the business but also keep you connected and keep everyone else connected as well. Yeah.
Frank Lama's Functional Five.
We have Frank's Functional Five, which is five rapid fire questions.
Frank is just here sitting beside you.
Yeah, yes. Hi, we do have Frank, a prolific online influencer for us across the world. Damien, question one.
So question one of Frank's Functional Five, what do you need to be functional?
What do I need to be functional? Oh, goodness. I think it'd have to be my wife because, like, she does so much of the stuff behind the scenes for me that if I didn't have her, like, I'd just be completely non-functional.
Very good, very good. Now, as far as it relates to work design, Who would you like to hear from? Who would you like to hear interviewed in from another company?
Oh, gee. I've loved LinkedIn as a business, and I use LinkedIn all the time. And these guys are technically the people who are all about, you know, role, jobs and employment and, you know, opportunities for people. I'd love to be able to hear from, like, you know, the people associated with LinkedIn, whether it's, you know, the CEO or whether it's, you know, the people in their people and culture team, as to how they think about these exact sort of issues.
Yep, awesome.
You've mentioned a couple today. Can you think of what's your favorite shortcut or hack to designing a good workplace?
Oh, goodness. I think for me it has been the one-page accountability. You know, just being able to really clearly have that one thing that you can refer to all the time, like, rather than having multiple, you know, documents. That's the thing that's been a hack for us.
Yeah. Out of interest, where do you store that?
Google Drive.
Okay, no, that's okay. Google, thank you. Thank you for pushing Drive together. Awesome. Knowing what you know now, building a company to 100 and had to do it all again, what would you try and tackle first and get ahead of what you've now experienced?
Look, I think for us it has been some of the more alignment type of tools. So, you know, I think, you know, when you're fast growing, there are opportunities everywhere. It's very easy to just get distracted by trying to pursue anything and everything. For us, being able to sort of have a, you know, sort of look, we talk about it as the podium, like in the business, just being able to align people around three things, not 30 things, which is where we've historically been, and trying to, you know, sort of bake that into all of our processes so that, you know, it lines up with our OKRs and other things. Like, you know, I think that's the focus thing. Focus really is a thing.
The magic number of three. And the final fifth. Frank's final functional fifth. Oh my goodness! The fifth question: What's the most valuable resource or asset you can share with our listeners?
Oh wow! Look, I have to admit that the resource that I'm using a lot of at the moment, and that I'm actually that's helping me, and to some extent, it's a bit like the alignment tools I was talking about, is Trello. So the ability just to store virtually everything in my life on Trello, whether it's the CEO business related thing, or even I've introduced it at home now, so my wife uses Trello. It's awesome. Like, you know, just being able to track where everything's going and whether things are on on track for completion and stuff like that is actually pretty cool. Like, you know, that I know it sounds really lame, but like, I've never actually had that level of organization before, so like being able to coordinate that amongst lots of different people is actually pretty important.
Wow. Awesome. Well, look, thanks, Marcus, for joining us. We loved hearing a bit more about Health Engine, your growth journey. Just recapping, Health Engine, 110 people, built in Perth, Australia, but servicing the whole of Australia, doing over 1.1 million doctor's appointments a month, and scaling with big investors like Sequoia. Marcus, thank you so much for coming along. We loved having you on the show. Damien, again,
thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having me here. And we look forward to introducing you to our next guest soon.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining Tim and Damien, co-founders of Functionally, on their quest to make work work better. If this episode has given you value, please share this with another leader. And don't forget to subscribe. Subscribe now to make sure you're among the first to listen to the next episode of the Work Design Podcast. For more about the latest in global work design trends, head to functionally.com and sign up for our monthly Work Design publication.